This is tomorrow's notice board.
Hello, my name is Tristan Nieslein, and this is the Tomorrow's Motorsport podcast. And I'm joined by Nick Butcher. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Tris. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm in London at the moment, so it's meeting after meeting and having a great time. But we're here to talk about Simon Reynolds, our guest for this week's podcast.
Yes, driver performance. And when we talk about driver performance, there aren't many more out there as experienced as Simon. Simon was the driver performance manager for McLaren for 14 years. So he's worked with the likes of Lando Norris, Stoffel van Dorn, Sergio Perez, Lewis Hamilton, to name but a few. He was looking after the young driver program. So all those young drivers that were coming through, Simon worked with. Most notably, actually, and very topical at the moment, is that Simon has worked with both Alex Albon and Nyck de Vries, who, of course, in Monza, we saw poor Alex having to make way for Nyck through ill health. Unfortunately, he's better now. But it was great to see Nyck do so well and finished eighth in Monza. It was a really good time to catch up with Simon, a really good guy to speak to, and probably not many more better to discuss what it's like to have driver performance and how we can put that into business.
Absolutely. Simon was such an engaging guest that we've split this one into two parts. The episode you're about to hear goes pretty in depth to how drivers prepare in elite motorsport. And I think from that point of view, if you're a driver, even if you want to know what the drivers get up to in terms of getting prepared for elite motorsport, this is a no-miss episode. And then in part two, we look at the future of motorsport for driver performance from somebody who, as you rightly say, knows his onions, is one of the top in the game.
This is tomorrow's motorsport.
We are joined by Simon Reynolds today. Simon, it's great to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us on Tomorrow's Motorsport. How are you? How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's absolutely our pleasure. You currently work with elite drivers across a range of motorsport series, but it'd be really great to get a bit of your background. How did you end up doing this?
My friend's mum saw a kind of advert in the paper as opposed to social media. And back in the day, a part-time role at McLaren. So I, at the time, I had my own business, and I was a personal trainer. So I was training sort of general public and a few athletes at that time. And I went for the interview, turned up at this incredible building, which looked like something out of James Bond, walking through these white corridors, getting to the end, going in this lift, which seemed to take forever to get up to the top, and the doors opening really slowly into what is obviously the McLaren Boulevard, which looks out across the lake with glistening water and the sunlight and just something you just sort of dream of. And then you turn around and there's all these historic cars positioned around the boulevard. And obviously, being a car nut since I was probably a fetus, probably knew about it even before I was born. I mean, I'm obsessed with cars. I played with cars all my life. Since I was a child, I would just, you know, play, get the little mat out and just pretend I was a driver or whatever it was. So, yeah, I've always loved that side of it. And to combine, you know, the training aspect with motorsport just seemed like a dream. So I went in for the interview. I was greeted by Lewis's physiotherapist. And the two Formula One trainers at the time, and also this magnificent man who became my sort of lead or manager as such, the chief medical officer, Dr. Aki Hintzer. And I thought, what on earth am I doing here? And sat here, and they're asking me lots of questions about myself, about my kind of morals and how I look after people and my goals and aspirations for the future, etc. And I left the interview shaking, I believe, and my heart rate was probably about 220. And I drove home thinking, there's no way I've got the job. And it took a week and I didn't hear anything. So I thought, there's no way. And I remember sitting in the car park of the health club that I was working at, and I got a call and I got the position. I couldn't believe it. So I actually ended up getting both part-time positions into one full-time role and began my journey with McLaren. And I had to give up my business at the time and let down quite a number of clients, which was tough. But I just believe that it was right. And of course it was. And then I started working at McLaren with Adam, who is Lewis's physio, an incredible guy, and learned a lot from him. And we established the Fitness and Wellbeing Center at McLaren, opened the doors to employees. And that's as far as I thought it would be. You know, it would be a role working with employees and working with potentially the race team. And that, of course, that became the case. Aki actually ended up leading first, as I know it, Formula One performance program or human performance program for the race team. And off the back of that, I started working with a young driver, Oliver Rowland, and also Jamie Green in DTM. They were my first drivers. And ironically, they both set up kart teams, which is incredible. Fantastic kart teams as well. And off the back of that, I moved then on to Heikki Kovalainen and working Formula One, which was mind-blowing. Spent a season working with Heikki, and then I returned back to the factory to manage the human performance aspect of the young driver program and responsible for the athletic development of the young drivers. For example, Ben Barnacote, Alex Albon, Nick de Vries, Oliver Rowland, exceptionally good karters who won the European and World Championships. In addition, the test drivers of the Formula One car, Gary Paffett, Pedro de la Rosa, and Oliver Turvey. And in addition to that, I was also a resource used to cover Formula One tests. So I would be the performance coach looking after Lewis at Formula One events, Sergio Perez. But the three main drivers that I supported from a young age through to the higher echelons of motorsport were Nick de Vries, Stoffel Vandoorne, and Kevin Magnussen. Kevin Magnussen and Stoffel from entry-level Formula through to Formula One in terms of developing their athleticism and their abilities to cope with the extreme conditions of Formula One and Formula Two, for that matter, and World Series at the time, 3.5. And Nick de Vries for 11 years from the age of 14 and obviously through into winning the Formula Two championship. So that's a little bit of insight. So I don't want to bore everyone with too much, but
it's absolutely not boring. I think we're sat here mainly in awe of all of these fantastic names that are, of course, quite household names. One of the things I really love is that it feels quite McLaren, from only knowing them from the outside looking in, to build up that aura and mystique of the slow lift going up and the lift doors opening onto the boulevard. It sounds phenomenal. One thing I'm really curious about there is when you were talking about your interview with McLaren way back then, it was about your morals and I guess your values. Probably maybe you just don't mention it because it's kind of, well, of course you talk about your competency, but McLaren kind of strikes me, and there are a few teams like this, but McLaren definitely strikes me, especially maybe that was something really important that actually even back then, the fit of the person, aside from just the competency, was really important in order to build an elite team. So was that your take on it? Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I mean, I feel extremely lucky, and I owe, you know, my present and my future to that opportunity. Mm. I've always believed in life that whenever an opportunity arises, no matter how much fear you have, you've got to take it. And if you don't, then you may look back and wonder what would have happened. Yeah. But for me, I've always been, I've had a fear of failure, and this is what drives me, is fear of failure. Being at McLaren, I felt extremely honoured and grateful for the opportunity every day. I mean, I couldn't believe I had, you know, literally, it sounds cliche, every day I would pinch myself to think, wow, this is, you know, do I really belong here? Because it's such an incredible place, full of incredible people, you know, right from the leadership down through to the person who keeps the building in immaculate condition. Every single person, every single element, every cog of the wheel is just as important as the person at the very top. And that's what I learned from McLaren, is that as a team, you can really build something incredible. And although you may go through periods of lower performance or reduced performance, if you have those values and you understand the mission, and you and every single person is committed and passionate towards that end goal, then there's no such thing as the end goal, especially in motorsport, but that continued evolution, then you will return back to the top. And I believe McLaren will be back to the top in the not too distant future. Just a wow experience.
Since McLaren, you started started a new company with Formula to Perform. How's that keeping you busy? What are you focusing on with Formula to Perform?
Yeah, absolutely. So Formula to Perform effectively is a culmination of 26 years of working in human performance and 16 years working in motorsport, assisting motorsport athletes, drivers in 17 different series of racing, from karting through to Formula One, but also GT and endurance racing. And the idea of the company is to prepare drivers in the right way, effectively, ideally from a younger age, to install good habits and develop the driver's athleticism specifically for racing, and also to help them transition from series all the way through that pathway. So I'm very much of the school of thought that when you take a young driver, you teach them and educate them and guide them about nutrition, how important nutrition is to help optimize your performance, but also to optimize your recovery as well. In addition, teach them the training principles about building physical literacy and about building the athletic fundamentals and the long-term athletic strategies that we need to implement in order to layer up a driver's performance. So that's where the good habits play a key role from a younger age. Teach them when to be serious and when to have fun. Teach them about communication skills and mentor them about all of the different variables and things that they need to consider based on experience working with other drivers that I've been lucky enough to experience. Teach them about how the environment impacts on them and building a holistic model of what performance looks like from the foundation layer all the way through to the performance layer. And I call this Perform Hex. So the hexagons of my logo, three Formula 2 Perform, there's three hexagons on my logo, which relate to the Perform Hex model of having the two hexagons below the foundation and then the performance layer on top. So I have another model with three layers to represent the foundation layer of mindset, nutrition, recovery, and movement or physical. And then above that, you then have your strength foundation, biomechanical foundation. And then above that, then you have your endurance foundation. And this then relates to your baseline of performance turning up to a race, your qualifying performance, and then your actual race performance, your endurance performance. And teaching that principle and that performance model to the drivers hopefully helps them understand the preparation strategy, the competition strategy, review strategy, or how they're reviewing and reflecting on their performance, whether they won or lost, and then the ultimate one, recovery. So everything is based not around performance, but around recovery as being the king of athleticism. And effectively, that's what the principles, methodologies, and philosophy is around Formula to Perform, is that that is the formula to help a individual perform. And then, of course, I also spend my time with working on Get Active Digital and applying those same principles to leaders of corporate business and employees to help optimize their productivity and workplace performance. And that's a culmination of what Formula to Perform does and stands for. And I'm lucky enough to work with a number of drivers in lots of different series of racing to install that education and guidance. Yeah, so it's the next chapter from leaving McLaren at the end of 2019. Going into 2020, and then 2 weeks prior to the first lockdown, setting up my company. So as usual, my timing is of the essence, as they say. And, quite a daunting moment, I'm not going to lie. I mean, Nick and I were having great conversations at that time, building a relationship, a new relationship, which we've fostered ever since. And hopefully that will grow in years to come.
And Simon, any drivers at the moment you're working with that we should be looking out for the future stars of the sport?
Yes. I don't really want to say the names because I don't want to pick out sort of certain names and not others. They're all fantastic drivers and learning and doing well within their series and championships. So they're all learning at the moment. In terms of all of the experience that I had at McLaren, all of the ups and downs from my experiences, things going right, things going wrong, you learn, mostly learn through failure. Mm. And I embrace failure. I didn't used to. It used to stress me out considerably. But now I know that through failure is where you really learn. And I'm not even sure failure is the right word, because it always has a negative connotation or relationship with how we perceive failure. But to celebrate success is obviously the ultimate.
Yeah, and just to interject there, actually, Simon, it's been really interesting to see, as you just mentioned, you and I probably started working together just as you'd started Formula to Form. So you're pretty fresh out of McLaren. And it's been really nice, actually, to see how you yourself have used those values at McLaren and developed that into your own business and business style, but actually moved away from some bits, whereas before you're probably doing that very McLaren. The guy that I met then and the guy that I met now, and the success you're having with Formula to Perform and establishing your own brand and moving that away from McLaren, but still keeping those core things, because obviously you learned so much over those 14 years. Yeah, it's great to have been, played a small part in that and witnessed it and see where you are now with, you were saying before we started recording, you're now looking after 8 drivers. So talk about those. Where are they in their career? Because obviously you've had a focus on young drivers. Is that the drivers that you're focusing on, or is it older drivers as well?
Yeah. So leading on from that, of course, things you learn and the values you build. They always say that when you've worked at McLaren, the DNA is still within you, flowing through your blood, as cliche as that is. But it's true. You learn a huge amount, especially working with an elite team and team of people. So I've always loved working with young drivers. Working in Formula One was the most incredible experience, but I felt my skills and my passion was really helping the young drivers from a young age, especially from grassroots. Through the different levels of racing, and not just Formula One. There's lots of routes. There's lots of incredible routes for drivers to sort of move through, and like GT and endurance racing, etc. But single seaters has always been a huge passion of mine, and will always be that way. So I've got multiple drivers, in karting, Formula Four, Formula Regional, which is kind of a stepping stone into Formula Three sort of level championship, endurance racing, Le Mans. Obviously, Will Stevens is somebody who I sort of support in his race preparation. And
I was going to say you've had some success with Will recently, because he won his class in Le Mans, didn't he?
He did, yeah, spectacular. I was so proud of him. He was with Felix as well. DaCosta, again, I've known from a younger age, incredible talent, and raced against some of the drivers that I supported. So, what a team. That was an incredible moment to witness. And if I can play a small part in a driver's pathway, then it's an incredible feeling. I only play a little part, but hopefully I can educate them on how to prepare ultimately, and obviously also to recover effectively to optimize their performance.
In elite motorsport, it's so much in the margins. If you're a good driver, you're a good driver. It is about how you prepare for those moments, right? Like qualifying, being absolutely top of your game for the duration of a lap, and then you're looking at something completely different in terms of the endurance aspect and keeping focus and concentration during a race. So what you do is incredibly important, though, because you're talking about those final percentage points.
you've obviously worked with Formula One drivers to go and compete in a Formula One race. You've also competed, you've also worked with someone like Will in Le Mans. Is that almost like training someone? It all comes under the banner of motorsport, but is that almost like training someone for a completely different sport?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it's a really important thing to touch on is what we call a needs analysis. So when you take a driver on, you need to understand them as an individual, but you also need to understand that the sport or level of racing that they compete in. So you have to have an intricate understanding of the individual from a biomechanical perspective, which is how their body moves and the requirements that they need for the sport, and also their backgrounds, how much training they've, or how much sort of structured training they've adhered to over the years. So we call that training age. We look at their maturation level, depending on their age, in terms of their growth. And then when it comes to the actual sports needs, then yes, if they need to spend hours in the car and be able to focus and concentrate, then there may be nutritional and training factors that we need to consider that are slightly different from levels such as Formula 4, Formula 3, for example, the more entry to mid-level racing, where the races are anything from in karting 12 minutes, moving into Formula 4, Formula 3, 20 to 40 minutes, maybe even 60 minutes as you then move from Formula 3 to Formula 2. And then obviously Formula 1 is 2 hours or 90 minutes to 2 hours. Then you have Le Mans, which you could spend 3 hours plus hours in the car. But then accumulatively, that can add up to, 5, 6, 7 hours maybe in the car. So yes, there are factors that you have to consider, and the needs analysis is extremely important, but assessing the individual is really important because we need to build a baseline of performance suited to their sport. However, if you have a young driver in karting transitioning to single seaters, for example, you need to start preparing that quite early on and not just moments before you transition. So you need to always be thinking ahead. So I'm never training a driver right now. I'm always thinking ahead for the future, to lay a foundation of performance, which can be layered up over time when you're working with drivers. So yeah, the needs of the sport and the needs of the individual are paramount.
Yeah, that makes incredible sense. And everybody is an individual. So, they are going to need different things in terms of that preparation. And to what you said before about having different pathways as well, where somebody go, actually, I really want to get to endurance racing, or I want to get to single seaters, or I want to do something else, then to think about the complexity of that over the individual just shows what an involved job it is. I think one of the questions that comes out of that, though, is do any of these most successful drivers that you've worked with, what do they have in common? How early are you able to identify that?
Yeah, so if you take a child at school, or you take yourself at school and look at the type of activities that you enjoyed and preferred, was probably the activities which you were good at. So for me, I had horrendous hand-eye foot coordination. So anything with a ball, absolutely useless. But when it came to gymnastics, running, athletics, the summer period as opposed to winter, I came alive and I was a good cross-country runner. But going back to as a child, you tend to then not enjoy the things that you're not good at. And the reason that you're not necessarily good at them is partly inherent in terms of the attributes you need to actually be skillful at an activity, but also the environment and how much practice you did as a child in those activities. So if something doesn't necessarily come naturally, it's certainly something that you can still practice and improve upon. It's really, I believe you're born a sprinter, for example, because your makeup, muscle makeup, predominantly fast twitch muscle fibers, as you spoke about, is correct, or slow twitch muscle fibers, which more predispose you to longer endurance activity. You can manipulate that in accordance with your training. So you can't change the actual fiber makeup as such, but you can change the characteristics of it. Effectively, drivers have similar attributes at the higher echelons. At the lower echelons level, you get you'll find the drivers that stand out, and the drivers that always, in terms of where they finish and the positions they finish, as opposed to the drivers who stand out, who tend to finish in the top five always. As they progress into the higher echelons of driving, that then becomes a little bit more magnified. Mm-hmm. So if we take the Formula One drivers as they have incredible self-belief, I think that's paramount, is they believe they can win.
Yeah.
I think as an athlete, you have to believe you can win in order to win. And there's no doubt about that. You know, 100% I can win.
Yeah. And what's interesting with that is even though that grid of 20 people all have self-belief, the top ones seem to even go that little bit further and have even more self-belief. When you look at, you know, the greats of the sport, whether that be Lewis Hamilton, whether that be a Michael Schumacher, whether that be an Ayrton Senna, they all had quite inherent belief that they were the best.
Well, I mean, going back to other attributes, I mean, communication skills are extremely important.
Yeah.
Learning from a young age how to communicate is paramount. So when I'm not just talking about radio communication in Formula One, but also how you communicate with your engineer, having a level of smartness, intelligence to be able to understand the engineering of the car and be interested in that.
Yeah.
It's so important that in my opinion, that drivers spend time at the factory. They spend time understanding the machine that they're part of. Because drivers ultimately are part of the machine. They're not just the controller. They're part of it, especially in the Formula One cars. But they need to immerse themselves into it to optimize the performance of the car itself. They have incredible commitment from a young age. They're hardworking. They put extreme work ethic to every day wake up with a champion mindset, focused on self-improvement, educating themselves into how can I be better today so I will be better tomorrow? What can I do today? What can I learn today so I will be better tomorrow? The best people in the world at what they do is because they put more effort in than anyone else into self-improvement. And this can be from an educational perspective. You never stop learning because you did a degree 30 years ago. And you haven't educated yourself since. It's incredible that you did that. However, I believe that education needs to be ongoing. We need to work our brains out as much as we work our bodies out to become the best athletes in the world. So making time to learn is very important, but also understanding how to recover is crucial. We cannot perform optimally, and science has proved this, if we're sleeping less than 6 hours. So when you see videos of celebrities saying that they wake up at 4 a.m. and go for a run or a workout and things like that, and they've gone to bed at midnight, they've had 4 hours sleep, you know, they are not performing optimally, cognitively and physically. They are not performing at a high level. They're in a suboptimal performance level, and it always makes them smile. So at least seven hours of sleep is going to help recover your body. Science still doesn't know everything about sleep, and we're learning all the time about it and how important it is. But sleep is fundamental for every individual. And for me, it's the medicine, the ultimate medicine for us to recover. So the other attributes, obviously you can't deny talent. And we say talent really, from a driver's perspective, is their ability to execute their skill. And that's really where it comes down to. And practice is the most fundamental part of that. So from a scientific perspective, we call this motor engrams. So neurologically, when we learn a skill, we need to be learning it in the right way and learning the right technique, because the mechanisms of the body, once it learns a technique physically, the brain then stores it as a computer program effectively. We call this muscle memory. So when you've learned it to a certain number of repetitions, it becomes inbuilt into your brain's processing. So the motor engrams that drivers then build up from their skill delivery in karting, we need to ensure every athlete learns the skill in the right way. It takes 10 times longer to unwind a poor skill or poor technique. So if it takes 300 to 500 repetitions to learn a skill or a technique, it takes 3,000 to 5,000 repetitions of good technique to then unwind that. So once we've learned the skill in the right way, and also suits us as an individual as well, because we all have our own idiosyncrasies and the way our bodies effectively work, that we can then apply that with practice, and practice layers up, reinforces that motor neural engram, if that makes sense. So we're reinforcing that computer program over and over again. So the drivers that spend more time in the seat applying their skill in the right way will become better. Like a tennis player playing in the right way, you're reinforcing that computer program.
Incredible.
And that's something I think is really important. They are selfish in a good way. So that's always a connotation of negativity. But so you have to be selfish as an athlete to perform at your best. You have to dedicate and sacrifice so much in order to be the best you can possibly be and reach your ultimate potential. Every day you need to pay attention to your nutrition. Every day you need to pay attention to your training and especially your recovery. Listening to your body, learning to listen to your body is extremely paramount. And they embrace pressure, their ability to embrace pressure rather than it stressing them out too much and causing them to be slower. And also building a strong team around them as well is absolutely paramount. If you can build the best team around you, you will perform undoubtedly. And science has shown that, especially with young athletes, if they build the right team around them, then they will perform at their best. And this comes down to family, friends as a foundation, and education and schooling, which is extremely important for drivers. And then it's layered up with other team members, like a team, if you're in the higher echelons of motorsport, a team manager, a performance coach like myself, who then has a number of specialists who filter the right information through to that person, who then delivers it to the driver. You maybe have a driver coach teaching them or developing their skill practice. Then you have the team itself, the race team itself.
No, thank you for that. It was a really, really great answer and really explained it even so well that I could understand it, because this is not an area I really get all the time, although I'm interested, you know, in my own health and stuff like that. It's a different level in terms of what you do. One thing I think we've seen recently is with technology and kind of the advent of, you know, really good simulator tools. And just to, while we're on the topic of that kind of science of practice, how important is the development of sims been in terms of supporting that preparation? I think when we hear about simulator work, it's generally been about car setup and getting it right for the circuit and so on. So I think my question to you is, do you use the sims in terms of driver preparation and in any specific ways, not just learning the circuit, but in terms of that? How does that come into your personal training and performance world?
That's a really good question. I mean, I've always used car telemetry and tried to understand as best as I can the engineering side. And obviously working at McLaren, I was very lucky to build great relationships with the most incredible engineers, some of the brightest people in the world, or much, much brighter than me. And learning a lot about brake traces and throttle responses. And when you start to communicate with engineers and understand more about the technical side and the engineering side of the cars, you can then relate that to your training and preparation. So if a driver's struggling in a particular area of their skill delivery, it may be a technique issue which a driver coach or the engineer can help them with, or it may be a physical issue which obviously then I can help with, or it could be a combination. And the idea is that you're working together to help the driver ultimately prepare. The technology of simulators has grown exponentially over the years, and drivers and teams recognize that they're very important. And with less track time than in the old days, it's more important than ever that drivers use simulators. And the Formula One teams have the most incredible high-tech simulators, which are astounding and very, very close to the actual or the reality of driving a car on track. Apart from the environmental constraints and G-force, vibration, etc., they behave a little bit different, but the actual driving or skill application is very similar. So yes, the technology is very important to allow a driver to prepare ultimately and combine that preparation of skill practice and track familiarization. So in terms of when you have a race event in the not too distant future or coming up, then you would dedicate your time in practice in the simulators to familiarizing yourself with the track, familiarizing yourself with gear changes, brake and throttle responses, and also your ability to deliver your skill prior to the event. So when we talked about those motor engrams, and apologies if that was a little bit in depth, but you're reinforcing and starting to ignite those neural pathways. Like you imagine a Christmas tree where you put all the lights on a tree at home and you see them flickering and all turning on. If we can do that with a driver and combine that with the simulator, but also with the visualization techniques, which science has shown to be very effective, that athletes actually close their eyes, visualize themselves, engage, and actually go through the circuit, visualizing themselves doing it, it actually does reinforce the brain with the same neural pathways and the same delivery that they experience when they're actually in the real scenario. So there's lots of things that we do to combine with the practice itself on track, away from the track. And ultimately, the things that we do away from the track help them prepare and help reinforce their baseline of performance, so they're able to then deliver their actual skill effectively, subconsciously almost, without too much conscious thought, in the right way, and then they will perform ultimately to their optimal level. So me as a performance coach, my job really is for them to turn up with the highest level of baseline performance as possible. So the nutrition is close to perfect. There's no such thing as perfect, but their nutrition strategy is effective. Their hydration strategy as part of that is effective. And especially when they're driving in hot, you know, high temperature, high humidity climates, that their training is applicable and is appropriate to optimize and prepare them for the actual event, that their mindset is composed, and that they are able to deliver on the day, not just in the car, but also everything that goes on over a race weekend and the other factors that they need to consider, that they've practiced in the simulators and that their baseline of skill delivery has already been activated. And then when they get in the car, they immerse themselves in the car, they have a sensory stimulation from what they see, what they hear, what they smell, etc., what they feel, the kinesthetic feedback from the receptors of the body picking up on the motion of the movement of the car, the vibrations, etc., and then centrally process that in milliseconds to then know, based on experience, of how to deliver their skill physically. And that's effectively my job, is to enhance that and prevent fatigue of that loop.
That's absolutely fascinating. And what if something's off? What if any of those elements is off? You know, maybe the hydration isn't quite right, or maybe the nutrition hasn't quite been right.
So cognitively and physically, they won't be at their optimal level. So from a cognitive perspective, then they won't be able to, their thinking process and the feedback mechanisms will be slower in effect. So, I mean, that's very, very basic, but everything within their actual performance level will be reduced, and their fatigue rate will be higher. So they will fatigue at a quicker rate. One thing that's really important as part of their training is that a lot of drivers and maybe performance coaches to some degree are always trying to chase performance.
Yeah.
And when the driver could have a weaker foundation, then in terms of their body, they will fatigue quicker. So what I mean by that is, my methodologies of training a driver is to build and reinforce the strongest possible foundation, and then layer up performance. Because if you chase performance through superficially enhancing your body with resistance training, for example, without having a solid foundation and not being athletic, building athleticism and robustness of the body, then you will fatigue at a much quicker rate. So going back to the baseline, that's where it's so important that we prepare the drivers properly and effectively from a young age and learn those good habits, so then they're able to deliver that performance effectively.
Interesting. And it'll be my final question on this part, but do you have to make trade-offs? So we often hear you're doing things that are good for you, practically speaking, but actually in driving, you need a specific thing. So in terms of nutrition, in terms of weight training, in terms of cycling and things like that, in order to reach that point. And is that difficult to achieve, that balance?
Yeah, really, it's very tough, because we can't be ultimately strong and have a ultimate endurance level. So we call that concurrent training strategies. So we're trying to balance the strength that we need and the robustness we need to protect their vital organs and spine under compression, vibration, oscillations, porpoising that occur during racing, and to protect them ultimately from injury. So that's why the foundation, as I call it, is extremely important. So we have what we call the local stabilizers of the body, made up of your diaphragm, your pelvic floor, your what we call the transverse abdominal muscles, the deep core muscles, and the multifidus muscles along the spine. There's some of the muscles which form part of that structure to help stabilize and support the spine. And they're really important as part of breathing as well, to enable us to breathe effectively in the lower lung and expanding the rib cage, etc. But the protective mechanisms in the car are very, very important, especially if a driver crashed, and also the G-forces they experience. So we talk about G-forces, the acceleration of mass in the X, Y, and Z axis. So for drivers in Formula One, as opposed to pilots, we're talking more about the X and horizontal and lateral Y axis forces on the body. So in cornering, Formula One cars can generate anything from 4 to 5 G laterally, and then up to 6 G under braking in that horizontal force. So they have to have extremely strong and robust neck and shoulder complex to support their head, which weighs approximately around 5 kilos. Plus the helmet, that's talking about 6.5 kilos, and you multiply that by the G-force, and that's the kind of load that they have to endure. So anything from 25 up to 35, maybe even 40 kilos of force that they will experience multiple mass on their bodies. So that's why they need extremely strong necks and stable necks to support that structure. So you've got to then, going back to your question, think also about the endurance and thermoregulatory parts of racing. So in the hot, humid climates, the cockpit temperatures can reach 50 degrees. They're wearing race garments. So they have undergarments followed by Nomex race suits, boots, socks, gloves, balaclava, helmets, hand device. They're completely covered in these microclimates, or they form microclimates within the cockpit. So you've got these three microclimates. They can't thermoregulate their body temperatures effectively to cool the core. In 50 degrees of cockpit temperature, this is why they need to have extreme levels of fitness to be able to cope with that, especially in Formula One for 90 minutes to 2 hours. And then you're thinking about things, why are they fit when they're not moving dynamically like a footballer? Well, because they're withstanding enormous amounts of G-force combined with enormous amounts of thermoregulatory stresses on the body from the environment. And also, multiple applications of braking under around sort of 80 kilos. It's measured in different formulas, but around 80 kilos of force against the brake pedal multiple times on one limb, but then also having fine motor control to be able to apply the throttle and brake at the same time, which you can have massive amounts of force, but you've also got to control that force and have real fine control over it. And then, of course, biomechanically and ergonomically, the seats are not ideal for drivers to spend huge amounts of time in. They're in a very flexed spine position, forward head in terms of the postural changes, and then very flexed at the hip and knee. So I spend a lot of my time as a performance coach working a lot on what we call prehabilitation, preventative injury exercise, to unwind the postural discrepancies that can occur from being in that ergonomic position.
Stretching them back out again after being in a really...
Absolutely, yeah. Well, they're very much in flexion, so they become very flexion dominant, anteriorly dominant. We want them to be more in extension, especially if their training is really important, because if you're loading a body that's taken out of its gravitational line of good posture, then you're going to load, especially in the spine, the vertebrae at certain points on the spine, which can then exacerbate injury. It can lock up the facet joints within the spine at those points, and then load is not dissipated through the body from the ground upwards when you're performing tasks like plyometric exercise, like jumping, moving around dynamically, skill-based exercises, etc. You're going to load your body in a very poor way, and then you'd be liable for injury as a consequence, potentially. So these are all the factors that you need to consider. So endurance training becomes extremely important because it's an endurance event, multiple repetitions. So we do a lot of longer duration exercise, biking, kayaking, swimming, rowing, running, walking, hiking, lots of multiple activities to build that endurance capacity and their aerobic base, but then also what you call sort of interval or tempo type training, where you're working at very high intensities and then having recovery periods between to then increase your VO2, which is the maximum volume of oxygen your body can intake and utilize, which again is important for athletes to build upon, especially if they're an endurance sport. But for drivers, the heart rates are normally between 170 to 190 beats per minute, around 80% of their maximum heart rate for that length of time of a 2 hour, 90-minute, 2 hour race. So they have to have very good levels of fitness to be able to just cope with the cardiac responses and the catecholamine responses of adrenaline, that the fight or flight hormones that are kicking in, that are exacerbating that heart rate. So those are the sort of factors that I consider when I'm training drivers.
Incredible. And of course, that kind of brings along with it kind of a certain level of emotional and mental stress as well that is constantly there when you're trying to control these kind of machines. Whilst I guess it's kind of like just sit for 5 minutes where you're just perched on your bum and turn your heating right up to 50 degrees and then try and thread a needle and see how you feel. Could you do it for 2 hours? I think it's, that's the picture that came to mind, but it's, yeah.
It really debunks the myth, because they say, oh, they just sit in the car and go around in circles. It couldn't be further from the truth. These guys are probably the highest performing athletes in terms of the what they are putting on their bodies. Every other week, they are going to a different climate, acclimatizing themselves to a different sleep pattern, different way of life. I mean, how do you... when you've got a driver, Simon, how do you kind of keep a structure when you have all these different elements on different in different parts of the world, different continents? What sort of take us through a day leading up to a race as they prepare? What things are you doing the same and what things are you doing differently?
Yeah, really good question. I was just going to say, Tristan, that I always give this really crude example of what it's like to be a racing driver in terms of sat in a bath with your feet on the taps or on just above the taps, and then don't do this, obviously, anyone listening, but then slamming your foot as hard as you can on your left leg into the wall multiple times whilst the walls of the bath are compressing you as hard as possible, and then playing chess and poker at the same time.
and again, in
50 degrees in a sauna. And then with obviously doing some form of physical activity that keeps your heart rate around 80%.
Yeah,
but, exactly. I mean, it's an extremely poor way of describing it, but it's quite a fun way to do it. But I mean, it just shows that they cognitively, mentally, physically, however we want to describe it, they do need to have extreme levels of athleticism, of composure, and then build this ultimate Formula One mindset that they've developed since grassroots. So as a performance coach, you are what I call a conduit of the best information of specialists in sleep strategy, nutrition strategy, sports psychology. So you, the multiple specialists are feeding this information into you to then formulate a strategy to help a driver prepare for competition. And part of that is dealing with time zone changes, which have an effect on your circadian rhythm, so which affect your sleep pattern. So when we sleep, we go into different sort of grades or levels of sleep, what we call the sort of deeper level of sleep in terms of dream sleep, etc. And we're coming in and out of these levels or phases of sleep. And part of that is to then prepare the driver in terms of their sleeping pattern, in terms of their nutrition strategy. So when they're moving from, as an example, where we are in the UK to Australia, and then from Australia, then they're moving on to the next continent, the next country, that they are mentally prepared for that, but physically prepared for that. And there's multiple strategies that we can use, in, as I've described already, to help a driver. So leading up to a race, the drivers would normally turn up earlier for a race that's further away. So Australia, at least a week to 2 weeks, they would arrive in Australia to acclimatize to the time zone and the different sleep patterns, so they can get their circadian rhythms back into a more productive, easier to manage level. And then this then helps us maximize their recovery in terms of their sleep, rest, and nutrition building up to the race from that point. So some drivers spend a week, get there 2 weeks before, but spend the first week on holiday, relaxing, composing themselves, and then obviously training is part of that process. But the training is where you would want them to be at their peak performance at that point to then optimize their recovery ahead of the race. So you're not developing them as athletes at that point, you're peaking them and preparing them.
This is tomorrow's motorsport.
Nick, what an episode that is. I think I learned so much in terms of what a driver gets up to, what is thought about, and the application around driving at the elite level of motorsport from Simon. Absolutely fantastic detail, and I feel much more educated. What were some of your takeaways?
I think it's understanding how much goes into what a driver goes through preparing for not just the race weekend, but a season in whole, as a whole. You know, drivers get quite a lot of criticism, I think, from the untrained eye. They say, well, it's just driving around in circles, and it couldn't be further from the truth. And, you know, discussing there what Simon does to and what the areas he considers from drivers that are karting all the way through to going into Formula One, I think it's very interesting, because what was right for one season, maybe even one race, if you're looking at you know, the temperatures in Singapore compared to a European race, all those different elements and what makes that. And you know, the great thing about Simon is he does know what he's talking about when it comes to driver performance. And so we got a really good in-depth look into every consideration that the driver, the performance coach, and of course the team has to do, not only to go racing, but also to protect their athletes. Absolutely. So no, I thought it was really fascinating from Simon. And you know, I'm interested for what people will think of part two when we go more into how he applies that into business, because there are so many crossovers. We are all looking for peak performance in business, but ultimately, sometimes what we forget is to look after ourselves. And so I think people will really get a lot out of part two as well, where we really look into that sort of practical ways of how to actually put it into action.
100%. One of the big things I took away actually is how Simon, as part of the driver's team, also fits into the wider team in terms of looking at telemetry, working with engineers, understanding how the simulator also kind of plays its role into the peak performance for the driver. But as you rightly say, next week we will have part two, which is looking much more at business and performance and how you can optimize yourself like an elite motorsport driver, but also what's coming in the future of driver performance. I think some of that is really, really interesting. So join us next week.
This is tomorrow's motorsport.